Hello there, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Chris Patterson, and my guest today is Herod Suarez, who is an assistant professor of English and Comparative American Studies at Oberlin College. We'll discuss his book, The Work of Mothering, Globalization, and the Filipina Diaspora, which was published by the University of Illinois Press in November 2017. The Work of Mothering focuses on the domestic workers that make up around a third of all overseas Filipino workers, and whose remittances back to the Philippines contribute to about 9% of its GDP, or around $20 billion. These migrants circulate through the world, serving in positions of nurture, care, and service. Professor Suarez examines literary, film, and cultural representations of these figures as part and parcel of a broader historical movement that structures the Philippines under globalization. To understand the multiple sites and histories of these figures, Suarez employs a framework that he calls the diasporic maternal, which focuses on the various forms of care and service that these migrants occupy throughout the world. Through a reading method that Suarez calls archipelagic reading, Suarez attempts to trace the undercurrents of these narratives that expose the feelings, desires, and strategies that exist outside of motherhood and maternal care. So I hope that intro made sense. If not, we can ask the author directly. So welcome, Herod. How's it going?
I'm well. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So let's just begin with an obvious first question. I'm living in Hong Kong, so we see domestic workers from Indonesia, but of course all over the world, domestic workers come from the Caribbean, Latinas, Indonesian, and a lot of other groups. And so why focus on the Filipinos here?
As you were alluding to, Filipinos occupy a significant percentage of that economy. And when it comes to Philippine-centric sort of narratives, they are also a prominent sort of figure in terms of the Philippine economy and Philippine history. So I think it's part of those bigger conversations that we're having about global labor and overseas domestic labor. But it made sense just in terms of my own kind of intellectual trajectory to focus on the Philippines and see what sense I could make of it through literature as I do in the book.
Okay. As you said, part of your intellectual trajectory, where did that begin, or what was kind of influencing the work originally? I think you wrote it for your dissertation, right? So I assume it started in grad school?
That's correct. So I was in grad school when the project began. And I think, at that time, I was in the mid-2000s, early 2000s, there was a lot of great sociological, social scientific work looking at overseas domestic labor from the Philippines, work by Rosel Pereñez, Ana Romina Guevara, Robin Rodriguez, and others. But I wasn't seeing a lot in terms of the cultural studies and literature angle. So Nefertiti Yar's work became really influential on mine and helped me to think more about how to make literature engage with these questions and what cultural production can have to say on these matters that can complement, supplement, but also I would say intervene in some of the work that was going on and that continues to go on in the social sciences. So the project comes out of grad school and out of that sort of set of inquiries. I was in an American studies program, so I was afforded the opportunity to do interdisciplinary work where literature and the social were central to the program. So it was in some ways for me, I guess, the perfect setting by which I could pursue this project. Mm-hmm. It helped me draw on my own literary sort of interests while trying to address things that seem to be pressing matters even in today's world.
I was intrigued also because, like you said, if you're influenced a lot by Nefertiti Tadier's work, both looking at cultural production and things like that, but the text that you chose, when I first looked at the book, the texts that you chose were a bit shocking to me because I was thinking like, okay, this is going to be about like movies like Iloilo, like that are quite explicitly about Filipino workers. But then the texts are talking kind of like some are a bit more canonical, like Bulosan's America's in the Heart, but then mm-hmm. short stories from Mia Alvar that you use, even though she, I think she's written a couple short stories that are quite explicitly just, you know, about these domestic workers. And then you chose other ones, I think, in that text that are quite different. So I think Nefertiti does similar things in her work as well. Like kind of talks around or uses texts that have these same themes, showing the history and the broader forms of reading to do them. So what kind of went into how you chose these texts? And not just Bulosan, but you also go over like Apocalypse Now, the diaries around Apocalypse Now, Perfume Nightmare. So things that like I usually wouldn't immediately communicate to be about this subject.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very important question about the book, because I think the text that are its focus would probably surprise other readers as well. For me, it made sense in terms of trying to open up the category of overseas domestic labor and open up the category of diasporic Filipino identity, because in that sense, I was sort of shifting away from the kind of empirical site, we might say, of, you know, specifically characters or figures that are or who are inhabiting actual positions of overseas domestic labor, and moving instead to think about the broader context within which a Filipino identity sort of travels in the world. And it's, you know, within that broader framework that something like, you know, the qualities that are also central to overseas domestic labor are actually relevant and operative, and also subverted by the narratives that I look at. So there's very few actually texts that I look at that are focused on overseas domestic labor, apart from maybe from that YouTube video that I briefly discussed at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is really about other, you know, the ways in which the diasporic maternal, which is what I call it in the book, that circulates within circuits of Filipino globalization, if you want to call it that.
Right. And so, yeah, this is a good way to lead into the diasporic maternal. So diaspora as in groups scattered around from the homeland, usually after some dispersal event. But what does it mean to see diasporas as maternal, if that's what the term is kind of doing? What does it mean to... What does diasporic maternal mean as a framework?
That's good. I think that for me, I was thinking about diasporic functions in my book with, you know, juxtaposed over and against globalization. So if we're looking at overseas Filipinos, diasporic Filipinos within circuits of globalization where there is, you know, dominant forces that are positioning them within the global economy and after histories of colonialism and empire, then the diasporic is a way to think about, I guess, what else is happening there within those processes. And then that's, I think, what gets towards what I do call the archipelagic reading practice. So the diaspora is this kind of underside of globalization, is what I call it, and I'm borrowing from a lot of people, mm-hmm. I think, when I make that claim. And then similarly, the maternal is juxtaposed against motherhood. So I'm not looking at empirical biological mothers. I'm thinking about the maternal, sort of maternal qualities that get naturalized and imposed on Filipino subjects as they become diasporic. So when we put that together, the diasporic maternal is really a way to name the subject that escapes the paradigmatic frameworks of globalization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was I think in your introduction, right, you talk about how something like less than half of most of these overseas, these migrant women are actually mothers, even though a lot of the representation about them is basically them as mothers or as kind of like sacrificial mothers, And so that there's of course this kind of this disjuncture right between the way that they're seen and stereotyped and as figures, right, and then the way that they're kind of trained to appear through the training programs. So I thought that was really interesting. And then there's a section also where you compare this form of like gendering to like the Manong generation, who are almost always males, right? And then more sexually defined, like prostitutes and entertainers, and then interracial marriage and things like that. How did you see, how did you kind of balance all those things? Because there's so many different types of gendering diasporas out there just for Filipinos.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was trying to figure out how to talk about Filipinos under globalization while taking account of the history of empire. So I think that, you know, I sort of play with the idea that if the little brown brother is the sort of the, you know, the symbol of, you know, benevolent imperialism, so that, you know, the Filipino would be incorporated into the sort of the national family, then, you know, and that was under the terms of U.S. empire. Then as we shift into nationalism, independence, and also neocolonialism and globalization, that little brown brother becomes a domestic worker of sorts. And pointing to the ways in which Filipinos are situated in very specific and directed ways, ways that are directed not just, and here's where I'm just reinforcing what you're saying about the sort of the real context within which overseas labor takes place, you know, drawing on the work of like of Ana Guevara and Robin Rodriguez, you know, the Philippine state is very complicit, right, in facilitating this image of overseas Filipinas as naturally compliant, naturally positioned for and suitable for domestic labor, and that works in concert with the needs of globalization. Those are the dominant things that I was sort of alluding to earlier. And then in terms of the, you know, to get back to your question about gendering and the where I think my work is diverges a little bit from Nefertiti Sadiyar's, I think, is, you know, a lot of her work, her great work, brings us to think about overseas Filipinas as sex workers, right? It's a really sort of evocative line from her book about how, you know, the Philippines itself becomes the prostitute. It's not just the specific sex worker. And so I wanted to sort of shift the discourse a little bit to think about the maternal, because overseas domestic labor is, in contradistinction to sex workers, you know, this very visible heroic sort of figure for the nation. And so there's a way to think about actually Filipino visibility and all the problems that they're in.
Yeah, it just feels like she's merging, I guess, ideas of prostitution, but with ideas of maternal sacrifice and like the kind of caring magic and sort of life force that enables that kind of comes from the way that Spanish colonizers also saw Filipinos. And so, I mean, you mentioned a bit of the history just now. Maybe we can go deeper into that history and just start with perhaps Spanish colonization, which is something that Tadiar also spends a lot of time on. You know, does the afterlife of Spanish colonization also impact the way that we see these workers now and the maternal now?
I mean, I think that's a hard question for me. I think that it's, in some ways, it's, you know, it's both. I mean, on one hand, you have the erasure of the Spanish presence in terms of, you know, the kind of, I guess, the American erasure of the Spanish presence in the Philippines, the attempt to, again, sort of reposition Filipinos as these sort of uncivilized natives who have not been, you know, subject to European rule for 300 years. And so there's sort of that's at play. And then on the other hand, you have the very specific, I guess if I had to really answer that, I would, I'm locating the overseas domestic labor specifically within the narrative of U.S. imperialism and then globalization, because that's really when that shift from the little brown brother to the overseas domestic worker becomes sort of interesting and operative.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be interesting to see how others might think about it within the broader sort of history of Spanish and American imperialism.
So I noticed in your footnotes you do quote at length the statements about like Christianizing that mm-hmm. coming from the Americas in the late 1890s, right? Mm-hmm. When you mentioned the little brown brother, so can you explain that figure and how that begins to morph into domestic labor or the kind of out-migration that we see now?
Sure. I mean, so the little brown brother was this sort of this trope, this colonial trope that you would see in, popular cultural discourses, political cartoons, narratives from the turn of the century. As the U.S. was, positioning itself as an imperial power, sort of in a newfound way, that, right, after the settler colonialism of on the continent, as the U.S. was expanding into the, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Hawaii, Guam, and Philippines, Little Brown Brother is one way in which that discourse framed Filipinos and framed the discourse of benevolent colonialism, where colonialism was unlike previous empires. It was not going to be this violent imposition or invasion, but it was going to be this civilizational discourse. We are bringing education, we are bringing religion, we are bringing Western values to these Filipinos, and we are going to welcome them into our family as these little brown brothers who would be educated not only by our sort of, not only through force, through coercion, but through the Thomasites, the USS Thomas, where dozens of school teachers descended upon the archipelago. And so there's, the little brown brother becomes this really important colonial trope staging U.S. empire. And that's where, that's where you start to see the Manong generation come in. A lot of the early migrants were these sort of, people seeking education, Filipinos seeking education or already educated. And then as you move into the 20th century and you move into the, after the war, so now I'm thinking about Kathy Choi's work, you start to see this way in which nursing becomes important,
mm-hmm.
right? So the shift sort of immediately right after World War II and right after Philippine independence, mm-hmm. you see this sort of move towards nursing and that sort of outward mm-hmm. Migration and into the U.S. and other places, which then becomes through Marcos and then on overseas domestic labor sort of like, at full tilt. And so there's this way in which I guess that colonial narrative haunts contemporary Filipino subjects across the world, because even if there is a sort of this promise of independence and promise of, this sort of neoliberal kind of self that even now the Philippine state is promising or guaranteeing, there's still these ways in which it's a highly managed situation, highly regulated in terms of facilitating, specific forms of exploitation. And so again, that's all that sort of sociological and historical stuff that other sort of academics have been doing really amazing work on. And what I guess where I'm sort of entering the conversation a little bit is to try to think about what, the creative side of these things, what cultural production brings to the table, what literature and cinema and art and poetry can, can help us see alongside these other stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like the way you put it as, the little brown boy who was never really meant to grow up or is kind of, no matter what, is always going to be seen as this kind of little brown figure, but then the gender can shift around. And it reminds me of, I think, Robin Rodriguez also puts it in a way where Philippines gained independence, but the "in" is in brackets. So I think all this kind of comes to head in your... So before we turn to the text, you do spend quite a while on the Marcos years and how those influenced the out-migration. And like you said, I think a lot of these, the sociological work has also talked about this, the labor brokerage state, right, the Philippines then becomes in Marcos. But can you explain a bit about why Marcos was such an important conjunctural moment?
Yeah, I mean, and Marcos is a really important moment for a couple of reasons. Marcos helped institutionalize overseas domestic labor, within right at the sort of onset of martial law, right? Overseas domestic labor becomes this, process by which Filipinos get sent overseas, something that was already happening with the sort of nursing trade. But now it gets roped into the conversation about unemployment, severe unemployment in the Philippines, the threats of a sort of a communist insurgency that were his alibis for imposing martial law. At the same time, and so it gets institutionalized, and that's what's crucial to understand about Marcos. The other thing, though, that I try to point to is that, the process has only proliferated since then. So, it's one thing to credit Marcos with institutionalizing it, which he did, but the ways in which he becomes this kind of, the sole figure held accountable for all of the sort of problems that plague the Philippines, as if his, since his departure and with a series of, more or less quasi democratically elected presidents, we are in a different place. There's, the growth of overseas domestic labor would suggest otherwise, I think, or at least complicate any kind of narrative of progress, because for that very vulnerable population, the exploitation seems to have only increased as the demand for that labor and for those remittances increases as well.
Yeah, I especially like your reading of of martial law as like the same narrative of martial law was kind of put upon the outmigration of domestic work, that this is a liberal progressive, like liberal democratic progressive thing, even though on the surface it's really not at all. Like domestic labor, outmigration, and martial law both seem counter to that, but I guess they incorporate into that narrative because they're both seen as temporary. But then, as you say, the longer that these processes go, the more that they kind of counter that their own narrative. So I found that really illuminating for the way I kind of understood where this is going. But so before you mentioned how, so let's get past from the history a little bit and talk about the method a bit, the maternal or the diasporic maternal, and how that leads to reading. This is always a difficult word for me to say, the archipelagic reading practices that you go throughout, that you take throughout the book and seem a bit scattered onto every text. And of course, we're thinking of the scattered islands of a littoral or archipelago, but you're also using that word in a more abstract or more like heuristic type of way. So can you explain a bit of what it means to read archipelagically?
Sure. And, I think that there's been this great sort of turn towards the archipelago that we see in American studies now. And so I think I was, energized by that discourse. As you say, the archipelago is it's a figure of islands scattered. I play with its etymology in terms of looking at how it actually in some ways refers to the waters around the islands and what to do with that. So to read archipelagically is then to not just read for for that sort of scattering, but read, as I say, I mean, read the negative image of that scattering, which is say, try to read the waters around those islands. And is there a way to do that that is getting at that sort of diasporic underside? So if there's a one way to tell the story about overseas domestic labor through sort of, social science tools of mapping the kind of exploitation of overseas labor, the ways in which the state is propping them up as heroes in order to facilitate that exploitation, how does literature encourage us to see what else is happening by giving us details into these characters' lives? Again, characters who are not, who are not empirically overseas domestic workers, but are part of a kind of diasporic Filipino sort of collective. And maybe collective is maybe I arrived at that word, fortuitously, because I think the archipelago is a way of thinking about connection in a scattered way. Mm. It's thinking about connection in a way. It's thinking about diaspora in a way that that resists, diasporic nationalisms, right? So there's always this nationalist call to belong in a very kind of, rigorous, strict, and disciplined way. But these figures who are, the figures that I look at and the narratives that I sort of probe into are sort of creating all these other kinds of connections. So that you see that in the different chapters that constitute the book. There's other things that are happening here that maybe get us to see, what I think I call the archipelagic underside of globalization.
Mm-hmm. I think that's when that term became clear for me throughout the book was the when you talk about the underside, the undercurrents. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you first conceptualize the term, you talk about it as like blurring the division between seas and islands, right? And so that, I guess that image stayed with me whenever you brought that term back, and I could see the kind of undercurrents that you were talking about through all these texts that don't, like we said before, are not explicitly about domestic work, not even explicitly about maternity. But then, mm-hmm. that it's always kind of there. And in a way, I mean, would you say these are also kind of the racial imaginings of Filipinos, or that these are kind of the way that Filipinos imagine themselves, so that we're seeing so that the archipelagic is kind of a way of seeing their presumptions about things like maternity, sexuality, and gender that aren't exactly the explicit, symbol that they're trying to deal with, but that it's all kind of there in the background, and that's what creates this collective in a way?
Yes and no. I mean, I would say that it is a kind of experience that's perhaps illegible to dominant ways of talking about, the experience of overseas Filipinos. On the other hand, I would be cautious about how I, make claims about their actual experiences. Mm-hmm. Because I want to think of, some of the readings that I do, I think, the characters themselves aren't even really intentionally subverting anything. They're just they're the ways that they navigate their lives are they're just sort of under the spell of a kind of archipelagic process that is not entirely definable by dominant narratives. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that. That the image that you begin with, the seas and islands, kind of doesn't just disrupt. I mean, it's about the epistemological presumptions, right? And how this type of reading contributes to, resists that and unsettles that. And so that was something very interesting. That one question that I want. So before we get to the chapters in the book. I like to ask about the writing process because academics are always trying to like talk around the writing process. But I did read this dissertation a while ago. I was in grad school when it came out. And so it's of course changed quite a lot in the past, you know, I think it was 2010 or 2011.
2010, yeah, I graduated.
Yeah, and so maybe I didn't get to it until a while after that. But can you talk a bit about how the book transformed throughout the years from dissertation to workshopping conferences to actually publishing, and you know, the review process, publication, and all the changes that have been happening in America and in the Philippines as well. Like, how does this book now compare to the dissertation, which was originally just for the kind of committee audience, and now it's for a wide academic and public audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the conference circuits, but it was finding people who are working on adjacent topics, and trying to make my work speak to them. I think was recognizing that there was going to be a bigger audience that needed to that I think could benefit from some of the things that I have to say. More specifically, though, I think transforming from the dissertation to the book was, as is the case with many people, the introduction, specifically making that much more grounded, and that happened, I think, really under the working with the editors at the University of Illinois, working with Martin Monalonson, who was just amazing in terms of bringing a kind of focal point to the introduction. Mm-hmm. So and especially in terms of, I guess, asking me to stake a greater claim in terms of the social scientific interventions that my project was doing. I think, the dissertation was very much grounded in historical and then especially in literary critical theoretical readings. Mm. But I think what I'm really happy about in terms of the introduction is how now there's a very specific context. There's focused kind of conversation there about how feminists are writing about overseas labor, and how the maternal gets, how the maternal functions in those discourses. And then I can sort of move towards the archipelago there, move towards the diasporic maternal there. Once that framework arrived to the project, it felt like a pretty different book by then. And then it's all the other, it's just all the sort of nitty gritty parts of revision, making sure that each chapter spoke to that new kind of framework. And that all happened kind of at the very end of the sort of timeline for this, but it does, I think you're right. I think it's quite different, even though some of the core readings are the same, but the context and their significance is different in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like to spotlight the whole contribution of editors and peer reviewers and things like that, because it's alarming when I have to explain what, especially a first book, right, has to go through, how many years it takes, decade is very, is often kind of the average, it seems, for the first book. It's always a fascinating process. Go ahead.
It just feels like a team, there's so many hands in it, and it's interesting, I think. It does make me feel excited to do it again, to write another book, because I think now I have a little sense of how this thing works, and it was a good process, I think, overall.
It's great. Let's start with going straight into the chapters, and I only have about one question per chapter, so I think I want to try and pinpoint some of the major concepts that you go over. And the first chapter, it feels like the basic like focal point, as you said before, could be to this excessive writing, or writing excessively. And then how, at least when I imagine excess, I imagine it spilling over, conceptions of the nation, of globalization, of maternity. But I'm not exactly sure if that's where you're going with it. So can you take us through this concept of excessive writing?
Yeah, I mean, there's just my case studies, so to speak, in that chapter are what really drive the idea of excessive writing. So when I was looking at, I think, Nick Joaquin's The Woman Who Had Two Navels, and pairing that with, across decades with Mia Alvar's short stories. But in each case, right, there are these moments where the actual act of language production, textual production, is so, amazingly kind of described in ways that emphasize excess and that show how attempts to pin the subject to the nation, in some ways, attempt to foreclose that excess, but that those, in each case, the characters nevertheless get past that. They, language, sort of the language by which they are produced allows them to exceed the nation in disturbing and mystifying, in perplexing ways. I mean, I think one side note that it might be worth sort of adding is that, that there's no, the reason that I call it an archipelagic reading practice is because I'm not, there's no answer that I arrive at. I don't know that these characters give us specific strategies or solutions or ways to solve any of the problems that I'm framing in the book. But, and yet, what they are doing, or what these texts are doing, the way they function as texts, is to produce enough of a crisis that it makes us, have to seek other questions, if not other answers. And that's what they're doing in this chapter. They're writing excessively. They're writing excessively on their bodies. It's a woman who has two navels. This rumor that she has two navels. Or in this other, in Mia Alvar's short stories, where writing takes over the lives of the characters in both of the short stories I look at. Those are just really, it's a sort of a story-driven chapter, if you will, and it's, I think it's all the better for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're very different texts at first glance, like, as you say, decades apart, and
right.
Yeah, and one very diasporic writer, I guess both very diasporic, but one more grounded these in like Filipino literature these days, and the other, mm-hmm. yeah, a bit disassociated. So it was really interesting seeing those connections. And I think in the introduction you talk about Wong Kar-wai's movie, Days of Being Wild, right? So that, I like that. It's interesting seeing all these different archival like evidence and traces that this reading practice kind of allows for. Okay. Well, let's move to the second, because in the second chapter, you also talk about excessive writing. At least the way that you put it, though, that you're going in kind of a different direction with it. In this chapter, you're talking about Jessica Hagedorn's Dream Jungle and Apocalypse Now, and the diaries associated with Apocalypse Now. But you're concerned with excess, as you say, that as an excess that kind of stabilizes rather than destabilizes, and even if just temporarily. And you call it stabilizing an alternative whose coordinates are important to trace. So can you talk about this more stabilizing notion of excessive writing that you're getting from these texts?
Sure. The main character in Dream Jungle, the chapter is driven by, how that novel ends and her sorts of decision, the decisions that sort of inform her life. In that case, and similarly, but in more pointed ways, I guess I would say, in more specific ways, she gets asked to be a particular kind of mother within both and sort of a nationalist framework, and then by a kind of imperial framework. And that's where Eleanor Coppola's notes comes into the chapter, because there's this, the Dream Jungle takes place as a sort of fictionalized setting of Apocalypse Now, which was filmed by Francis Ford Coppola, and whose wife was joined him for much of the filming with their three kids. And so Eleanor Coppola's notes and the documentary that followed were interesting sort of ways in which we understood a kind of white womanhood in the sort of the post-colony. Struggles that she has, that she wants to be a filmmaker herself, but it feels really kind of like strapped by, you know, by the expectations put upon her as this, as a wife and mother. And so that, and then there's only a sliver of that, that Hagedorn fictionalizes in Dream Jungle. But with just that, I think Lena, the main character, has to respond with both of those as she has to figure out what to do with her life. And so I guess without giving too much away, you know, the ways that the novel concludes in contradistinction to both of those sort of avenues generates a different relationship to language and to the nation and to the maternal, right? Because she is actually a mother. And she's actually having to respond to these pressures, and yet she finds a different way out through her connections with other sorts of characters on the film, other animal characters on the film. And what's I think maybe most striking about the novel is that it ends somewhat ambivalently. I mean, we're not sure what to make of her, and I think that's important. I mean, I really play with that in my chapter because it ends in a way that, you know, I mean, the book closes, but how, what we make of that ending, I think determines how we read Lena and how we read motherhood after that novel.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this also speaks to your concept of excess, that she's like, even at the end of the novel, you don't feel the quite resolution of like knowing her truly. And again, that feels, I guess, both the destabilizing of chapter one, right? But do you feel like this also does kind of stabilize something for the audience that perhaps the previous chapter did not, in the sense of what excessive writing can do?
Maybe. I mean, I think I'm appreciating the way that you're helping me to sort of rethink that and those two chapters related to each other. I think maybe there is a sort of, you know, my readings of that excessive writing that Lena inhabits, there's a stability that she finds in that instability. I mean, that sounds like, you know, sort of a just sort of this wordplay there, but
That's exactly like, yeah, what I felt you were aiming at towards the end, is that to be stable with instability or be settled with unsettledness.
Right. That doesn't happen. That isn't the emphasis of the previous, you know, the stories in the previous chapter. I think you're right about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Then all these chapters are very well leading from one to the other, I should say, because this chapter then leads to chapter three, where you consider the diasporic maternal in Kidlat Tehimik's famous 1977 film, Perfume Nightmare. And this was also sponsored by, or, you know, heralded by Francis Ford Coppola, yeah. Right? And so that you have that immediate connection there. And this is usually seen as, you know, it's usually known for its, like, sharp visual aesthetics that explicitly play with kind of anti-imperial, anti-Hollywood forms. That this is also the way that it was kind of sold to the public too, so it's hard to get it out of that narrative. And I think this is my favorite chapter, probably because of all the theory that you kind of, all the literary theory that you use throughout the chapter, and cinema theory to read the text. But what do you get out of this film that considers, you know, the Filipino domestic worker and the diasporic maternal?
I think it's a fun chapter because it really indulges, I guess, in a bit of formal analysis in terms of, you know, its main thrust is to listen to the film and to mm-hmm. think about listening as a kind of a different way of analyzing a film that does not necessarily add up to or simply complement the visual. Mm-hmm. And so in Tahimik's film, through a close reading of it, and through a close reading of a very specific scene, there's a way in which that disjuncture between the visual and the oral allows for the opening of something else for the viewer. And so it's interesting that that was your favorite chapter. My first published essay was a slice of that chapter. Mm. And it's a very different chapter, I guess, because it engages with film more so than the other chapters.
With queer theory, right? Like I think this is where José Muñoz and Halberstam and people become more relevant, right, in this chapter. If I'm remembering correctly, and the anti-imperial, anti-Hollywoodness also says a lot as well about straight time, heterosexuality and these things too.
Yeah. So in both this chapter and the next one, I think queer theory becomes more important. Here it's thinking about the children in the film. And again, sort of to read them maybe against the sort of heroic and main character of the film, who is played by Tahimik himself. It's interesting to think about. So this chapter is also different because it focuses on children rather than maternal figures. The maternal figure in the film is sort of less interesting in terms of the ways I'm thinking about the maternal.
Mm.
I guess she, along with her, with with Tahimik's character, inhabit fairly, I would argue, sort of conventional modes of subjecthood that the children that I read in just a couple of scenes, kind of resist, and they resist it through that kind of interplay between the visual and the oral, the sonic, in terms of how the film actually plays out. But I do, I wanted to emphasize the sort of aesthetic there. This book is committed to sort of literary critical readings, as interdisciplinary it is, as much as I'm invested in sort of social questions and political questions. I think that the literary critical is crucial to complicating those questions. And not in a way to sort of, I guess, romanticize or fetishize the humanities, in some sort of older or more conventional and more problematic kind of way, but because there's actually things that we learn from the texts that are in front of us, if we pay attention to the nuances the way that I tried to in this chapter and in others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so let's go to your last chapter, where you talk about the diasporic maternal within immigration to the United States through reading Bluson's America is in the Heart and Brian Rowley's American Son. And this, it goes back to what you were saying in the last chapter, how the maternal figures are there, but these texts are mostly known for building a kind of male Filipino-American, like Filipino-American masculinity, with all the tributes and problems of that. And so how do you, this chapter was probably, for me, when I was thinking about it, like, this is was one of the most shocking in the way that it takes two texts that we think we know, we think we have pinned down, right? Like, as you're saying, they have these excesses, and then the archipelagic reading does something different with them. And so can you explain a bit about how you read these texts, given the diasporic maternal and all the queer theory that we were talking about before?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, the Bulosan part with which I begin the chapter is really indebted to both Rachel Lee and Martin Joseph Ponce's readings of America is in the Heart. I try to bring those two into conversation with each other. In terms of the sort of gendered reading of the text and of the sort of transnational doubled mode of address in America's in the Heart, and I bring all of that to think about another sort of marginal figure in that book, one who is not the main character, but who is a sex worker. Who seems to be a sex worker, who has this sort of interaction with Carlos as he publishes his first book of poetry, and I try to think about what the significance of that in terms of a Filipino identity in the U.S., the character's relationship to other migrant laborers, his efforts to bring migrant labor and creative writing together in such vexed and complicated ways that he arguably fails to do so through by the book, the end of the book, because precisely of her sort of intervention there. And so I think that marginal figure becomes really important to what how that book actually works, and touches on things that are happening throughout the book in ways that I think we haven't fully absorbed. And then I bring that actually all the way to Brian Rowley's American Son, because of the sort of small accident. And it is an accident. I actually talked to Brian Rowley about this. He didn't know that he wasn't aware that America's in the Heart travels through Medford, Oregon, which is where American Son's character travels through. Sort of a nice coincidence, which I, I sort of tried to juxtapose and play with. And so in American Son, I bring that to the question of liberal multiculturalism, sort of heteronormative multiculturalism, and the ways in which that book queers any kind of sense of belonging, not just to a kind of national identity, but also to a kind of sort of homonormative kind of American sense of belonging. That character is the main character there is unresolved. And so if that's the case, then I turn to his mother, who is very much a kind of a, I think the way that most people would tend to read her is something that I resist. I think there's something else going on there, and so I bring attention to that as that chapter ends. Long chapter, but it seems to make sense to end with her, because she actually becomes this kind of like the marginal figure in America's in the Heart. Is somehow the book is as much about her as it is about the main character.
Mm-hmm. And in a very nice way, the kind of rereading of like paternal texts or texts about masculinity is then followed in your conclusion, where you talk about the most paternal figure, Jose Rizal, the father of the Filipino nation. And so why conclude a book about the work of motherhood with this very paternal figure, and how do you reread his I think it's his last letters, right?
It was his, it's that sort of under-examined moment of his, of the legend of his death, where he is supposed to have turned around when he was being, he asked to be turned, he could face the firing squad. The petition was denied and he turned around anyways. It's such a, it's such an interesting moment in his life and in the life of, of the Philippines, that in spite of all the work that is written about Rizal, there's not a lot of mention of that. And so I wanted to sort of play with that, and going back to, the transformation of the little brown brother to the overseas domestic worker, I try to think about Rizal not only as the father of the nation, but as the sort of maternal figure, the diasporic maternal figure, par excellence, because he ushers in this narrative, he ushers in the kind of a century and on's worth of, the kinds of impulses that are driven by nationalistic independence, but also the undercurrents that are happening there all throughout. And it's all those undercurrents that I, you know, that are marginalized, that I think I link to the marginalization of his turning around. I mean, I think there's, I guess the fact that we as a sort of a critical community have not done as much with that turning, that gesture of his, in his final moment, you know, it speaks to the other things that we may have, you know, turned equally away from, that we have marginalized, that we have not figured out how to read, that we have no archive for, that we don't know how to archive, perhaps because of the parameters of our sort of dominant epistemological frames.
Mm-hmm. Which, in a sense, are the very things aimed at us, right? this image of turning towards literally the guns or the weapons.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you know, I mean, there's so much to play with. I mean, you can play with, I think I talk about Lot's wife turning back. You can think about Benjamin's, you know, angel of history, mm-hmm. Turning back and looking at, you know, so it was a fun, I wasn't sure how to fit it into this project, and I thought maybe I'd have to save it for something else, but it made sense as a kind of, you know, sort of interesting epilogue to the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, yeah, it was very, very interesting. I liked how it again kind of comes pretty organically from all the thoughts in the book and how you reread masculinity in chapter four. So to kind of conclude, I'd like to, because this is a wider audience than most of the, a lot of academic writers have in mind, you know, on the podcast forum, I like to always ask, you know, do you envision the book having an impact on, you know, Filipino diasporas, the lives of foreign domestic workers or in other kind of perhaps non-scholarly or non, you know, quote unquote academic contexts?
I mean, I would hope so. I wouldn't be so presumptuous as to immediately claim so. I think that, of course, like with this kind of work, it's, you know, to invoke one archipelagic metaphor, it's about making waves, right? It's about sort of like, if there's a way in which it can, through several sort of channels or processes, impact the ways that we think about them, and that can maybe impact, you know, that process. I don't really imagine that that's the case. The world works in, you know, in different ways, and but I think that, you know, at the least, it would be interesting if, and I've yet to look into it, it would be interesting to have this book circulate in the Philippines, and see what, you know, what kind of reception it gets there, and, you know, and maybe there it can, I know that, yeah, I, as an interdisciplinary text, I think ideally it would, you know, there are, you know, non-academics who might find it interesting, but at the same time, it's also, you know, it's very much a book written within specific kinds of professional parameters, and so, you know, one can only hope, I think.
Well, great. Okay, so thank you so much for joining us and for answering all these questions. Do you mind ending by sharing with us any new research that you've been working on? You described that you might be interested in or that you're ready, set to write another book. So what feels next for you after this?
I mean, I have no idea. I mean, I think that even though the archipelago is important to this book, it was something that arrived to it fairly late in the process. I think, I guess I'm saying all that because there's a lot more to be said about it. There's a lot more that I want to do with it. And so I think my next, whatever it is that I do next is going to probably engage with that in a more substantive way or in a, but also maybe thinking, yeah, I'm not sure where to go with that, but I want to stay with the archipelago and think about what other kinds of work it can help produce.
Okay, fabulous. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. Take care.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening to my interview with Herod Suarez on his book, The Work of Mothering. If you have any questions, grievances, or suggestions, you can message me on the New Books in Asian American Studies Facebook page. Thanks.